I want to thank Connie Rockman and all 15 members of the Caldecott Committee for giving me this terrific award and for making possible all the honor and prestige it's brought me in the last 5 months. I also thank them deeply and sincerely for the opportunities the Caldecott brings in its wake. Public appearances in person, on TV, on radio, and on tape give us the gift of seeing ourselves, as well as seeing ourselves as others see us, which is really a great gift to have, so I thank you. My congratulations to the other winners, and apologies for the banquet program. As the saying goes, do a caricature, lose a friend. Some of you are my friends, and I don't want to lose you. Others I'd like to know better. I hope my drawings haven't screwed up our relationship. Thanks to Judith St. George for writing the smart, funny text that inspired my pictures for So You Want to Be President. As it happens, Judy and I met for the first time only a few months ago, long after the book was on the market, and I was happy to find she is as smart, as well-spoken, and often just as cheeky as her text is. I think I can speak for Judy, too, in expressing thanks to Patricia Gouch, Vice President, Senior Editor, and Publisher of Philomel Books. Patty is a savvy and, to use her own favorite word, sassy lady. She's sensitive, energetic, and a caring editor who helped in many important ways to guide and shape this book, and it was her idea to bring Judy's text and my illustrations together in the first place. I want to give very special thanks to my art director, Cecilia Young. Generally, when you're working with an art director for the first time and you announce that you're planning to work in a new style, there's this long, dead pause on the other end of the line, during which the art director is calculating how much money to offer you to kill the job. Cecilia didn't seem at all fazed that I wanted to take a fresh, looser approach to my art for this book and went along zestfully with everything I proposed. Well, almost everything. And, okay, not always zestfully. There are several members of my family here tonight, among them my three stepchildren, Ginny, Mark, and David, who've been a wonderful support and encouragement to their evil stepfather these past 5 months, and who, for 25 years, whether they know it or not, have been a source of great pride and satisfaction to me and their mother. Jin, Marco, LD, I thank you and I love you. I want to send thanks to George W. Bush and Al Gore for prolonging the election so that our book could stay on the New York Times bestsellers list for a few extra weeks. Nice work, fellas. Thanks must naturally go to the great, hardworking team of marketing and publicity staffers at Penguin Putnam, and especially to Angus Killick, who was one of the first people to predict that this book would be a huge winner. Looking backward over my career, I'd like to give long-distance thanks to Alan Benjamin, whom I haven't seen for many years, but who gave me my start in publishing in 1980. Alan persuaded Macmillan to take my first book, and during the short term he was senior editor at Crown, he convinced them to acquire Imogene's Antlers. His inventive and twisted mind obviously recognized in me a younger brother. Stephen Roxborough, now the publisher of Front Street Books, was the other twisted genius who gave me my second big boost up. Stephen brought both me and Sarah Stewart into the Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux corral and molded and guided a few of our early books. Stephen tended to flick off the table anything that did not meet his high standards, and because of this, I continue to learn a lot from him. I'm proud to say that all the books that I and Sarah have done with FS&G are still in print. This is mostly due to the completely archaic and totally fiscally irresponsible publishing practices at Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, where good money that might be spent on things like swank offices and editorial assistants' salaries is lavished on the books they choose to publish. To all our friends at FS&G, our deepest thanks. Mary Reif of the Kalamazoo Public Library Children's Room was a fortune teller back in 1982. She predicted that I would one day win the Caldecott. I merely laughed at her. Mary has been a friend and faithful supporter all these years. She's retiring from service soon, but she came out here from Michigan to be with us here tonight. Blessings upon my wonderful agent, Holly McGee, for being direct, tactful, for being such a mensch, and for always being on my side. The last person I have to thank is really, ever and always, the first one on my list, Sarah Stewart, who is often my collaborator, my best and most honest critic, my friend, my darling, my soul, and also my wife. Without Sarah, I tell you this in all honesty, I would have been dead, spiritually if not literally, 25 years ago. Patty Gouch reminds me that my sketches for So You Want to Be President began to flood across her desk before the contracts were even signed. This shows how eager I was to do the project. The thing that excited me most about this book was that it offered me the chance to combine the work I've been doing for years as an editorial artist for publications such as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, with the work that I'd been doing also for years in children's books. At last, I thought, the child and the adult in me could meet and shake hands. One of the ways I've managed to duct tape together a living as an artist is this combination of careers, editorial and children's book art, each competing to see which could be the less lucrative. For a long time, my life has consisted, on the one hand, of drawing, as it were, chickies, bunnies, and duckies, and having that work interrupted by magazines and newspapers, calling upon me to draw caricatures of people like Tanya Harding, James Carville, and Linda Tripp. In 1987, for example, I was working on the finished art for a book about kangaroos and koala bears by Beatrice Schenck de Renier, when Playboy called me to join the interview team on the Jessica Hahn story. I dropped everything and flew to New York. For 2 full days, in a suite at the Plaza where Jessica Hahn was sequestered under a false name for her protection, I attended those disturbing interviews. At night, I returned to my own hotel room and drew Hahn's memories of being sexually coerced by the Reverend Jim Baker in a Florida motel. It's a wonder, then, when I returned home and resumed work on my children's book project, that the kangaroos and koalas for the Schenck de Renier story didn't end up looking like hucksters and degenerates. Or maybe they did. That book sold like hoof and mouth disease on a boot heel and has long since gone out of print. This kind of mental and professional disconnect has been the benchmark of my working life for over 25 years. So, with the opportunity to illustrate Judy St. George's book about the presidents, my inner child and my inner adult finally did meet and sat down together to share the same box of crayons. Philomel Books became, then, the daycare center for this not always peaceful playtime. My inner adult, as it turns out, would not share, play fair, or cooperate. He wanted to hog all the art supplies and tended to express himself more forcefully than anyone else in the room. One of the great problems for Patty Gouch and Cecilia Young was reminding the editorial caricaturist, that is, the adult David Small, that he was working on a children's book, and that in spite of many rich opportunities for sophisticated political satire offered by the subject matter, children would inevitably make up a great part of the reading audience. It would probably be best, David, if you didn't have President Gerald Ford diving into that empty swimming pool. At the beginning of this project, I often felt that my most potent ammunition was being taken away from me, and that I was marching into battle armed with nothing but a slingshot and a bag of marshmallows. It was the clash of two professions, a mix-up of métiers, an opposition of occupations, and for a while there, it got pretty dicey. However, thanks to Patty and Cecilia, to their good sense and patience, I found a way to make the book funny without being vulgar, irreverent without being too offensive, and sharp without being savage. Hopefully, too, we found a way to help readers, young and old, take another look at the leaders of our country and see them neither as divinities nor villains, and certainly not as representatives of some impossible dream, but as men with both great abilities and great faults. In other words, to help people see these men as what every president has proven himself to be, a fallible human being. As I told you at the beginning, it's been an amazing 5 months, and the Caldecott Award has caused me to examine myself in a way and with an intensity I've never had to do before in my life. It has turned a big spotlight on me and shown me the switch for turning on another big spotlight inside myself. One of the things that made this speech so problematic to write was my having to be careful to make a distinction between revelations that were enormous for me personally and ideas that would be appropriate to share. Although I've had a lot of illumination shed on certain threshold experiences in my life, it would not necessarily be useful to drag these out in public. There is one point, though, that to feel good about myself, I must make. And if it involves a certain measure of personal openness, so be it. You'll have to forgive me. It's not whining. It's the only way I know of to effectively make this point. In all our travels this spring, to schools and libraries in cities from one coast to another, Sarah and I have been disturbed more than ever before by the nearly total eradication of the arts from the schools in America. Children who need the expressive outlet of art, music, dance, and play acting have none of it. At the best, they listen to a visiting author or artist for 45 minutes. And those people might as well be visiting from the moon, as remote as most children are from the real human and very necessary activities of writing, of drawing, of playing an instrument. These things are deemed by school administrators as luxuries when they are, in fact, necessities. As someone so rightly pointed out, few people get chills from doing a math problem. Art and music are the things which speak to the human soul. These necessary tools of human expression have become the exclusive property of a small, elite group when they should be ready and available to all American school children. Ask any teacher, and he or she will tell you that the biggest troublemakers in school are often the best artists, that the most troubled boys, and let's face it, the kids who in recent years have unleashed the most serious damage have been boys, are also often the ones who draw obsessively in their spare time. In the fall of 1967, when I was a substitute teacher in the Detroit public schools, I was sent for a few days to sub, that is, to babysit, for a class at the city jail for high school-age criminals. Most of the boys I encountered there had been imprisoned for crimes like breaking and entering, but one among them was a murderer. Before I walked into the room, I was told by a guard I would meet this young man who, for the sum of $200, had shot and killed his friend's father. Nervously, I prepared to come face to face with a monster. When I finally saw him, a couple of the other students pointed him out to me. For a few moments, I was taken aback by a complete reversal of expectations. Instead of the hulking, drooling demon I had anticipated, I met a boy who reminded me, physically and spiritually, of myself when I was in school. Thin and starved-looking, he didn't speak. Avoiding eye contact, he hung around the edges of the crowded room, as far away as he could get on the periphery of things. Looking at this kid, I was suddenly thrown back into fifth and sixth grade at McDowell Elementary, where hurtful words were hurled at me every day by students who took my underfed and underdeveloped body and my reticence to participate as a reason to cull me from their herd. Those spurious names were leveled at me so often, I came at last to identify with them, believing that they branded my future. Furthermore, no one at home did anything to help or to alter that image of myself. Now, in this young murderer, I saw me, and I asked myself, could I have gone that route? There were big differences between him and me, of course, in class and in the opportunities afforded us. No doubt, by virtue of my circumstances at birth, I had more to look forward to than he ever had. I also had talent and ability in drawing that had been nurtured since a very young age. In my socioeconomic class back in the 50s, it was acceptable that a child make art. Lots of art, if he wanted to. At least, I had that option, while I'm pretty sure that that young man did not. So while it was difficult to see him ending up like me, I could easily see myself having ended up like him had I not had the option of the arts. Crime and violence know no class boundaries. But the arts in education do know class boundaries. We've seen flourishing arts programs in a few schools. There are the hallways and the classrooms are richly covered with paintings and filled with music, making these environments quite simply delightful to be in, as well as a delight to learn in. But these are for the most part in private schools in wealthy communities. But even wealth is not an indicator of a full education for children. In March, while on book tour, Sarah and I were in emerging affluent neighborhoods with new elementary schools where there were no arts programs and the libraries had been lost to computer centers. In all too many schools across America, the halls are silent and the walls are empty, but for a list of rules to follow in case of a fire drill. When I see a wall full of colored-in Xerox turkeys, I also see emptiness. Furthermore, I am underwhelmed when I listen to anyone extolling the virtues of the computer over things created by hand, as if drawing is an activity related to the Pliocene epoch. My school did not have the greatest arts program going, but at least it had one. If there'd been no art room, no music, no school plays, an outsider like me would simply have been driven further and further underground. As it happened, because I was allowed to develop my art skills, by the end of seventh grade, I wasn't being called those nasty names anymore. Instead, the kids who used to call me a punk because I was bad at sports